Morning, everybody. Good to see you. Hey, Chris. It's good to see you. If you don't know me, I know there's lots of new faces around, so I'll introduce myself. My name's Jared Siebert. I am the tech support coordinator for Lakeview Church. I'm also a church planner. And today, we're going to be talking about PowerPoint, audio reinforcement, and basic principles of lighting a video. I'm pretty excited about it. We don't talk about it enough here, in my opinion. No, I'm kidding. I'm here participating in this sermon series called Against the Grain. We're looking at the parables of Jesus. And I don't know if it's because my life is going in a thousand different directions, but my ADHD really expressed itself in this sermon this week, and so enjoy. Okay, so a picture has been playing in my head this whole week of when I've been looking at this parable. I've been thinking about this parable. We're looking at the parable of the workers in the vineyard. Oh, forgot. Preaching shirt, activate. This is M.C. Escher's art piece called Relativity. It was first printed in December of 1953, and it depicts an impossible world. So if you look closely at this picture, there are three separate sources of gravity in this picture. The three main staircases actually form an impossible shape called a Penrose triangle. I'll show you what that looks like. That's a Penrose triangle, and it's impossible. And if we look at this picture, to make sense of what's going on in this picture, you have to allow your imagination to imagine three possible sources of gravity. And at the risk of over-explaining art, which is something you shouldn't do, because apparently pictures are worth a thousand words, I'm just going to let this sit in the background and see if it speaks to you the same way it spoke to me as I was reflecting on this parable. So, Against the Grain, Parables of Jesus, and whatnot. Here we go. So, one of my favorite authors, his name is Robert F. Capon, and he has written a book on the parables of Jesus. Now, I don't always agree with his interpretations. I don't always like where he goes with stuff. I think he's always witty, he's always brilliant, and he's always imaginative. And I'm always better for having listened to him before I begin a sermon on the parables of Jesus. But I find this really, really helpful. He subdivides the parables of Jesus into three categories. There's parables about the kingdom, there are parables about grace, and there are parables about judgment. And the kingdom parables are always ones where he compares the kingdom of God to growing things. Things that are tiny and unnoticeable, and they grow all by themselves, and they don't need anybody's permission to grow, but they just do it. And then, of course, we have the parables of grace, and they're about the incredible, selfless love of God. Love that gets dramatized in these death and resurrection dramas that highlight who God really is. That's one of the main functions of Jesus, everybody, is to point us to who God really is. If you don't know God's heart, if you're worried that he might be this or he might be that, look at Jesus, and that's who God is. That's what Christians believe. It's what makes us Christ followers. It makes us Christian. And these parables are like, think like Good Samaritan or the prodigal son or the lost sheep or the lost coin. And then finally, we have everyone's favorite category, the parables of judgment, right? Everyone loves a good judgment scene, right? Everyone enjoys being judged, right? Right? Yeah, everyone likes it. These parables feature dramas about inclusion and exclusion. And they usually contain a surprise or twist ending in which the insider is actually the outsider, and the outsider is actually the insider. People that you think should be there at the end, people you think should do well in judgment, don't do well, and people you think don't do well in judgment wind up doing well. And it's often really, really surprising. And so parables like the wedding feast or the 10 virgins with their lamps, or parable of the talents or the sheep and the goats, those are sort of parables of judgment. And the parable I'm going to be reflecting on today fits into the judgment category. And it gives us a sneak peek into the direction that God is taking the world. It speaks about final things and how God will work everything out in the end. And just like all the parables of judgment, it's important to pay attention to the fact that the people caught up in this drama already belong to the central character. So if you think about the sheep and the goats, both the sheep and the goats have one shepherd, and that is God. In this story, they are all employed by the same person. In the parables of the wedding, they're all invited to the wedding, but not everybody shows up. And that's the mystery we're going to be digging in today. So if you want to read the original text of today's parable, it's in Matthew 21-16, but I'm just going to go ahead and retell it myself, if you don't mind. Okay, so this is Jared's version, the JIV. So a couple questions just to think about as I retell this story is, what are you seeing and what are you learning about God's judgment here? Who are the real insiders and who are the real outsiders? And how does it all begin with belonging and acceptance? And who, through their own choices, is on their way out? Okay, so basically here's how it works. There's a man who owns a vineyard. And the challenge is the days are getting colder, and he needs to get this crop off now because there are frost warnings. And are you waving at me? No, okay, not waving at me. All right. There are frost warnings coming, and this guy needs to get his crop off. And the workers he already has in his employ, they are doing a great job, but they are not ready to pull in everything almost overnight. And so this landowner, this vineyard owner, he goes into the marketplace and he just hires anybody that is looking for a job. And so he finds some people who are looking for a job, and he goes into the market early, first thing in the morning, and he hires a bunch of people, and he says, I'll tell you what, I'll pay you really well for today. I'll give you, let's say, $1,000 to come work for me for one day to help me get this crop off. And he brings them back, puts them to work, and he realizes, I don't have enough workers. And so he goes back out, it's 9 a.m. now, and I mean, if you're a farmer, that's half the day's already over. And he's going at 9 a.m. and he finds some folks and he says, listen, $1,000, you can come work for me for the day. And he realizes, gets them all home, this is not all going to come in with the people I've got. So he goes back at noon, at 3 o'clock, and finally, he even goes at 5 o'clock. And he says to the folks there, I'll tell you what, come work for me, $1,000, and we'll get this crop off together. Now, the people at 5 o'clock, he talks to them a little bit longer. He's like, so this is like a job interview. He's so why are you standing around here doing nothing? It's 5 o'clock. And these folks said, well, no one would hire us. Now, I think that's important. Why would no one hire these people? We don't know the answer, but I'm just asking you to think about what are the possibilities for people not getting hired. Some of that could be injustice. Some of that could be justice. These are lazy, good-for-nothing roustabouts, louseabouts, loafers. But anyway, he finally gets the crop off the land. They're headed for the wine presses. And He gets his foreman and he says, okay, line everybody up and it's payday. And he starts with the people who were hired last, he starts with them first. And he gives them $1,000. And of course, human nature being what it is, those folks are excited because they're like, is this guy nuts? We worked for $1,000 an hour. How did this even work? Maybe I don't want to ask too many questions in case he changes his mind. Maybe this guy has a screw loose. Maybe he likes being generous. Maybe he's not that smart. But whatever, I'm getting paid. And those folks who got paid the $1,000 start talking to the people who got hired, and they're doing the calculations in their head, right? The people that got hired at noon, quitting times at 6, okay, maybe I'm getting $6,000. The folks who started first thing in the morning, they are like, the cash register sound is going off in their head, okay? But as each successive group comes up, they get paid the exact same thing that the people hired at the end of the day got hired. And this starts to cause a little bit of anger. And in the Greek here, the NIV, if you ever read it, it's a very good translation. I'm not trying to talk trash, but they like to smooth things over and make things polite, okay? The landowner is using some gangster terminology here. The NIV says, listen, friends. No, he's saying, look here, pal. Listen up, buster. Like a 1930s gangster kind of thing. Listen here, buddy. Listen up, bubbo. And he's saying, why are you angry? You agreed to work for what I said. I did what I said I would do. Why are you angry? And he asks a weird question. He says, are you envious because I am generous? And then the scene stops, cliffhanger, what happens? And then the point that he makes at the end is he says something like this. He says, so the last are first, and the first are last. So this morning, as we think about this parable, I want you to open your hearts up to the hilarious, strange, compelling, and restorative power of God's judgment. Let's dig in and talk about the strange heart of God. So, for many of us, when we imagine God's work in the world, especially when it comes to things like judgment and God's last actions at the end of time, we imagine it will have something to do with God finally getting even with sinners and blessing the good people. The sinners get the stick, the saints get the reward. Bad people go to hell, good people go to heaven. Now, just because that's what most people expect God to do, doesn't make it true, and it doesn't make it Christian, but at least it's something we expect. And the people in the story expect the exact same thing. They expect that efforts and the things that they do will turn into higher and bigger rewards. And this parable, what it does is it helps us, or it asks us, to reimagine what we understand in our mind's eye when we think about God's judgment, about what the final things will look like. It asks us to reimagine and ask you, are you willing to be surprised? Are you allowing yourself to be open to the heart and mind of Jesus and try to understand what Jesus is trying to communicate? So key to our parable right here is the relationships between the workers and the landlord and the workers and each other. So I want you to think about this in terms of two groups of workers. Okay, we've got a landowner, we know his story. We've got two groups of workers. We've got people who showed up at the early part of the day. They bore the brunt of the work of the day. They did all of the work. They handled the heat. They did all the stuff. And then there are the late workers. And the late workers, we don't know why they didn't get hired throughout the day. Nobody else wanted them. That's key to this story. But this employer said, yes, come on board. So let's talk a little bit first about the early workers. The early workers, to be fair to them, they seem like square-dealing folks, like an honest day's work for an honest day's wage kind of a person. But they have a very transactional relationship with the owner. If he pays, they will work. The terms of the deal are satisfying, and so they're on board, at least at the start. And they have a slightly contemptuous attitude toward the late workers. They have theories as to why those folks never got hired in the first place. Perhaps they see them as defective or lazy. Maybe they think, oh, this landowner, he got really desperate and he ran out of options and that's why he hired them. But whatever, keep your head down, do the job, you'll get paid. Now, the late workers, what are they like? What is their relationship? Well, they also have a transactional relationship with the landlord, but they're starting to see him as different than the early workers. The early workers, their vision of this landowner is fair person, fair wage, fair work, makes sense, everything's logical. The late workers, they're already entering into this story like, okay, what's the catch? Okay, like seriously, what is wrong with this person? Is he just bad at business? Does he have a screw loose? Is this guy an easy mark? Is he generous? Is this just from good place? They have a very different picture, and they enter into the story from a very different gate than the early workers did. Whatever it is, the late workers are feeling pretty lucky. A full day's wages for a few hours' work seems too good to be true. And maybe this landowner is rich or dumb, we don't know. But whatever, if this guy is going to give me the money, I'm willing to take it. And even if they see him as an easy mark, an easy person to take advantage of, whatever it is, these folks are willing to stick around to see how this all turns out. Does that make sense? All right. So now let's talk about how the relationships begin to evolve or change over the story. So the relationship between the later workers and the landowners, it stays the same or somewhat improves. So they came into this business thinking that the landowners were nuts or generous, or he's given them ample evidence that he might be both. But hey, if this guy has any work, one or two hour openings next week, I'm likely to show up next week. I'm likely to repeat this story. You'll notice that the early workers do not have the same attitude. Even though they agreed in the morning to work for a particular wage, after it's revealed how payday works with this landowner, these late workers are not so sure that next week when they're in the marketplace and this person needs some help, I don't know that they will return to him. Even though he paid them fairly, even though he did exactly what he said he was going to do, they're not so sure they want to be involved in this enterprise. Kind of an interesting little transition. And it could be that what's happening in their heart is their sense of fair play is getting messed with. Because they believe at core, the gravity of their particular staircase is this: that if you follow the rules, you expect the landowner to follow suit. That the world operates according to the rules. And they don't mind a world in which lazy, defective, or down and out, or undesirables get the shaft. A good world has winners and losers in it. And their motto is, don't be a loser. Besides, losers usually deserve it anyway, so who cares? I can't or won't play. If you can't play or you won't play by the rules, you're going to get what's coming to you. A just world, you pull yourselves up by your bootstraps or you fail trying. It's your choice. This landowner is a total ripoff artist. The trick he's pulling is completely unfair. We deserve better. We deserve more. We earned it. And if this guy has any openings up next week, you can count me out. Now, the landowner, you're noticing, is remaining neutral. He's extending an invitation. He's kind of telling a bit of a mischievous joke. And the cliffhanger is really, what is he going to do next? He might, it's just as likely at the end he goes, ah, just kidding. And he evens things up. Or not, we don't know. And what he's done is he's established a space in which these folks are free to make his choice. But his heart is being expressed, and his heart is about generosity. And that's actually the joke that he's telling. That's actually the game that he's playing. It's ridiculous, silly, compelling, mysterious, restorative generosity. His weird way of being generous is really disrupting a system, a set of assumptions, pre-existing stories, other gravities that are at work in this story. And this payday, you better believe, is going to be the talk of the town. And people will now relate to him differently based on the choice he's made and based on whose version people hear. Some will see him as wildly generous or maybe a little silly in the head. Maybe they'll see him as an easy mark for future exploitation. And some will see him as dangerously unjust and completely untrustworthy. And however they see him will say more about what game they are playing, what gravity they are obeying, than anything else about his true heart or what he's doing. Most people are going to miss the joke. And this landowner is playing a very dangerous game with human emotions. His particular brand of generosity could land him in small claims court pretty quickly. He could find a pitchforks and torches gang on his front door that night. Or he could find himself completely surrounded by swindlers and grifters who see him as a soft-headed mark ripe for the picking. But for those that see him for who he truly is, a generous man who is disrupting a system, he could be onto something. What isn't possible for a guy with these kinds of resources who's willing to play an entirely different game? And so there's possibility in this story. And what you see the landowner as you approach this parable shows who you really are. What you choose to do with what you see determines whether you will join forces with this business or seek to destroy it. Insiders or outsiders, it's all your choice. This parable invites us to see God in a different light, to see the landowner's heart, to be drawn in by his generosity, and maybe join him in this work of generosity. It invites us to get in on the joke and start telling it to others. If we look at John 3:17, famously, this passage we skip or forget about when we read John 3:16. This is John 3:17-21. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already. So you belonged, and you've made yourself condemned. You've done it based on your trajectory and who you are. Because they have not believed on the name of God's one and only Son. This is the verdict. The light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. Not because they don't belong, but because the things they're already doing are about to have a light shone on them. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light, not because the deeds you're doing are good. This isn't a story about who's good, who's bad. Bad people hide themselves. Good people are ready to come into the light. Both kinds of person may not be ready to come into the light, and both kinds of person might be ready to come into the light. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly what they have done has been done in the sight of God. There is something about God that a person that's willing to come into the light, that there's something about God that they trust. They trust that if there are bad things, God will make a way. If there are good things, God will see that. They trust completely in the landowner's justice and generosity. The deeper work of God in this world is not rewarding winners and punishing losers. That is the condemnation business. When you hear someone who, you know, if they enter into a church and they maybe say a bad word, or they are like, oh, this is maybe a challenging thing for this group, and they talk about lightning. You know, have you ever heard of someone who's like, oh, I might get struck by lightning if I do this thing? You know, that's not in the Bible, right, that God hits people with lightning? You know who they're talking about when they're referencing lightning? Zeus. Zeus is not Jesus. They share a few letters in common in their name, but they're not the same person. And often, our pictures of God are more informed by Zeus and Greek culture than they are who Jesus is revealing God to be. So God is not in the condemnation business. God is in the rescue business. And God is in the business of rescuing the early shift workers and the late shift workers, because there is a very real chance that both groups will misunderstand who he is and what he's doing. The evil deeds the early shift wants covered up is the contempt they have for their neighbors and the manipulative and transactional relationship they have with God and their willingness to live in a system that constantly creates winners and losers. In the final analysis, they are content to be the winners and for others to be the losers. Their creative energy doesn't go to changing the game. It goes to making themselves winners and others losers. It goes to serving whatever game, whatever gravity gets them off the hook and hangs someone else. They play by the rules, not because they share a common heart with the landowner. They play by the rules to avoid getting punished and to earn rewards. This entirely misses the point of the rules in the first place, and it misses the heart behind the rules. It's callous, it's cruel, and it's contemptuous toward anyone not willing to play their version of the game. And this is the warning here, friends. Religious systems and ideologies often make a perfect disguise for the evil intentions and dark deeds of the early shift workers. You can look close to God with your actions, but your heart can be very, very far from God. And this is the warning that God is placing in here. And honestly, this is directly pointed at religious people. So listen to this and pay attention to this. Now, the evil deeds of the late shift workers is their willingness to do whatever they feel necessary to get whatever they want. They aren't necessarily captivated by the generosity of the landowner. They don't trust it. They don't depend on it. If they did, they would know that all the things that they're trying to take by force in life, or cunning, or rule breaking, is already freely being offered to them by this person. The light reveals all that they are willing to do to get what they want. That's what the light reveals. It reveals how they bend whatever rules they want in order to get ahead. And it reveals who they're willing to step on, including a generous, potentially senile old person. It reveals what they're willing to ignore. It reveals what they're willing to accept. And they justify it all by the claim that they are alone in the world, and all they have is their own devices to get ahead. They completely ignore all the landowner has to offer. Those are two possibilities as you meet this landowner. Those are two possible choices. But there's a third, and that's where we want to move on. And just because I love Futurama, here's a Futurama version of this picture. God's acceptance is offered well before anyone even knows to go looking for it. The surprise twist ending in this parable is that the only difference between an insider and an outsider is that an insider receives God's gifts of acceptance and outsiders reject it. It's no mistake that this parable comes hot on the heels of the story of the rich young ruler. I want you to know that the chapter divisions and the verse divisions of your Bible are later, and they had nothing to do with what Matthew was trying to get across. They are just there to help you find stuff more easily, and we could find it together. But the story immediately preceding this is the story of the rich young ruler. So let me tell you that one very, very quickly. Rich young ruler, person who's got lots of money, in charge of lots of stuff, comes to Jesus and says, listen, Jesus, I like the cut of your jib. Seem like a good guy. Seem like you're teaching a new thing. Tell me this. I do all the rules. I follow all the rules. How do I enter and get in on this thing that you're doing? And Jesus says, well, follow all the rules. And the young man says, well, I've done that, but I seem to be missing something of what you're saying. I'm following all the rules, but I'm not getting it. What do I got to do? And he's like, okay, simply sell everything you have, give it to the poor, come follow me. You'll find out. And the young man says, thank you, but no thank you. And he walks away. And then Jesus says, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. I am not going to do what lots of preachers do and make that passage easier on you. Friends, at Lakeview, we do pretty good. We are upper middle class, and I am not going to save you from Jesus today, okay? And what Jesus says is, he says it's harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. I don't know if you've ever tried to thread a camel through a needle. It's impossible. It can't be done. Than for a rich man to enter the kingdom. And then the disciples say, for heaven's sakes, Jesus, who can even be saved with this logic? And he says, well, guess what? You nailed it. For human beings, this is impossible, but for God, this is possible. This is what he says, the first are going to be last, and the last are going to be first. These stories are tied at the hip. They belong together. The themes are really well connected, and here's the point. If this world is working for you, if either by accident of your birth or through your own abilities to play by the rules, or your ability to bend and ignore them and get away with it. If this world is working for you, then the kingdom won't. Let me say that again. If this world is working for you in the current way that it is structured, the kingdom will not work for you. Either by you cheating this system or by you following and obeying this system. If this world works for you, the kingdom won't. Here's what my buddy Robert F. Capon says. Jesus' plan of salvation works only with the last, the lost, and the least, the little and the dead, the living, the great, the successful, the found, and the first simply will not consent to the radical slimming down that Jesus, the needle of God, calls for if he is to pull them through into the kingdom. By the way, this is a book that we've referenced a bunch of times. I asked if it was in the bookstore. You guys have obviously followed our advice and bought it. It's sold out, but they're trying to get more. I highly recommend buying this guy's books. They're funny, they are interesting, and you will never be bored. So one of my favorite jokes that Jesus tells to sum up this whole state of affairs is this. He says, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Okay, so I know that's not necessarily a knee slapper, but it's funny in how precise and cutting the idea actually is. People for whom this world works do not feel ill. They don't see that something might be wrong. They don't see the injustice around them. They don't feel the deep unease with the way things are. The early shift don't seem to notice how their religious system keeps making the same people winners over and over. It keeps making the same people losers over and over. And they won't lift a finger to change it because it works for them. Why don't they see how unjust this system is? Well, maybe they can't see it. Maybe being a winner does not give them access to notice the losers. Or maybe they're afraid that if someone ever changed the name of the game, they would stop winning. Whatever the reason, instead of quitting this sick and twisted game that constantly makes some people winners and some people losers, instead of breaking the system and joining the landowner in the deep generosity that he's planning for the world, they fight against it. They invest themselves in keeping the game going. The late shift doesn't want a game change either. They don't want to owe anyone or depend on anyone or feel obligated to anyone. And sure, they hate the game too, but they found a neat little way to bend the rules and get away with it. And if they let up for even a second, they'll be swallowed whole. They will lose everything. So it's not surprising that neither group are ready to come to Jesus for healing, for justice, for transformation. And it's not surprising that both leave the doctor's office unhealed, because they're both, in their own way, still committed to the old game. So friends, here are the central questions of Jesus' parables. The parables ask you, what kind of person are you? Are you an early shift or late shift worker, trying to play the same old game? Or are you looking to play a different one? If your answer is, yes, I want to play a different game, Jesus has something to offer. Are you an older brother angered that your dad is celebrating the resurrection of your younger brother, your rule-breaking little snot of a younger brother, and you won't come in and join the party? Are you a younger brother that will step over his dad's body to get what he wants and cheat the game? Or are either of you interested in how your dad sees the situation? How your dad wants to live as a family? Are you a servant that's been forgiven much but can't forgive a little? Or are you willing to allow yourself to get swept up in the radical generosity of the king? Are you the kind of soil that receives these kinds of stories as good news for the world? Or will you leave all this good news for the birds? Are you sick enough of how the world works that you're ready to go to the doctor and get it checked out? Or will you ignore it and let it fester and kill you? Friends, there's an invitation in all of these parables we've explored so far in this series. Each of them cut against the grain of the way that our hearts and the ways of the world. They are an invitation to connect to God more deeply at the heart level of God, to join God in the renewal of all things, to get excited about the possibilities that God's weird and wonderful judgment can unleash on the world, to come and join the party, to enjoy the good jokes, to laugh at the surprise endings, to embrace the "I did not see that coming" kinds of plot twists. The cost of playing this new game, though, is to be okay with losing at the old game. It costs placing your trust in Jesus completely and allowing yourself to play the losing hand at the old table. To leave the old table and to join the new one. It costs everybody something. There is a reason that this plan tends to be attractive to the last, the lost, the least, and the little, and the dead, the late shift workers. There's a reason it seems to be attractive, because this kind of generosity is completely out of step with the way the world works. This rarely happens, folks, and so it's very attractive to that kind of person. And there is a reason that the living and the great and the successful and the found and the first often take a hard pass on this invitation. But the invitation is being made to all of us this morning. You can join this story. You can enter in. You are already invited. You are already employed. Who are you going to be?